Welcome to another edition of the Litigation Psychology Podcast brought to you by Courtroom Sciences. I'm Dr. Bill Kanaski. My guest today is a dear friend and a client, an attorney I have been working with. Are you ready? I've counted it, Chuck. About 20 years. We are both getting old. Trial attorney Chuck Ingram from right here in Orlando, Florida. Chuck, how are you?
I am great. That yellow dress from 20 years ago must be getting old by now.
The yellow dress story, and we have to start with this. So we were preparing for trial and doing a mock trial, and done a lot of witness prep. And one of our nurses, she was very nervous. I remember early on in that process, like most nurses are, a lot of crying, a lot of emotion. And we did a mock trial in which a handful of our witnesses were going to show up in person because we thought we were going to trial to essentially practice, right, in front of the mock jury. And she walks in with this yellow dress that just lit up the room. And she sat on the witness stand and the jury just melted and fell in love with her, her personality. The yellow dress, it was kind of like an illumination, right? It was amazing.
And the thing is, and I don't know if this is just me wanting it to be this way, but I don't know if you remember, she didn't document what she thought happened. Yeah. And the doctor did document something that she thought didn't happen. And maybe it's because of her impression. Maybe it was because she was live and the doctor was a video.
Yeah.
But that mock jury believed the nurse 100% yeah. over the doctor
yes.
and his contemporaneous documentation. So this is one of the reasons I do try to do things live when I can.
Yeah. Yeah. They fell in love with her. But she was a train wreck prior to this. We had to get her there, which is something we're going to talk about today. So just to kick off 2024, we have our CSI litigation podcast, litigation psychology podcast, MedMal series. And this is one of those topics. And I know, Chuck, you have a tremendous amount of experience in the medical malpractice arena. And I want to talk about several topics today related to MedMal. But before I get there, my first pitch is never a fastball over the plate, Chuck. I got to throw a little curveball that's maybe going to hit the corner. But the question is, you personally, why trial law? What was Chuck Ingram going to, like, if we could go back in time and there was no such thing as law, like, were you going to be a movie star, an engineer? Like, where was it before it was trial law? I'm dying to hear this answer.
I had a degree at age 19 in marketing and finance. So I was either going to sell washing machines for Maytag in Iowa, yeah. go to work for a bank, or go to law school. And went to law school, got engaged, needed a job. And
here we are.
And literally, I haven't interviewed again. That was my one and only, well, that was my first job, and I've outlived or outlasted everybody at that firm, and through about 10 name changes, it's still the same firm.
That's really a good story, considering how, which we're going to end with, how these younger attorneys tend to pop and jump around and not want to stick in there.
I may do that. It's only been 42 years.
That's unbelievable. So now I've been through a couple of those firm names, but Estes, Ingram, Foles, and Gibbs.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Excellent. That's an interesting background. This, I think you made the right choice. I mean, I could see you selling dishwashers very, very successfully.
And I've been to Iowa.
And you've been to Iowa. So have I. So let's talk about MedMal. And I want to talk a lot about the discovery process because, in fact, I just had a phone call today. Won't say who, but he's the national managing partner of a top three defense firm in the country. They have like 50 offices in all four time zones. And he had seen me speak. He had read a couple of my papers, and he called me. He's like, listen, I need you to, can you do a couple of CLEs for my attorneys, focusing on discovery and particularly with, you know, witness testimony and witness prep. And he said something very interesting this morning. He said, these cases are won and lost in discovery, Bill, and my people need to understand that. They need to be taking the right philosophy, the right approach to discovery, because if we're too reactive and not being proactive enough, we could really set up ourselves, you know, for disaster. So talk to me, because of your 42 years, kind of like your general philosophy when you're entering discovery, working up a case, and maybe where you see some of the landmines, which you really want to avoid.
Well, I think he's right. It used to be,
yeah,
that was the benefit of being a defense lawyer, or not the benefit, but a benefit of the defense practice. We were paid by the hour. You got paid for what you did. And so you tended to be, maybe in some cases, overly discovery-wide. Yeah. But that seems to have changed. You know, there's a lot of carriers and lawyers, frankly, who, you know, want to minimize discovery. And, yeah, you know, again, I'm not trying to build business for defense lawyers or plaintiff lawyers, but we... if all you do is react to what the other side is doing, then you're always at the disadvantage. You're always being reactive by definition.
Yeah.
And so, but like you say, if you're out there getting the paper discovery, and I say paper, it's all electronic now.
Yeah.
And, you know, that used to be, okay, you'd get in a medical record and it'd be 25 pages. And I used to train paralegals and legal nurse consultants, but you would, you know, the lawyer had time to actually look at what he was getting.
Yeah.
And, you know, glance at something and see, well, wait a minute, this lady to her orthopedist is saying she was just dancing on a cruise, but over here she tells her primary care she's on a Caribbean cruise for a week, and they were dancing every night, and she tells her orthopedist she can't walk, or you know, now with social media, you know, yeah, that people are out there, but I don't want to get hung up on social media, but it's not the only item of discovery.
Yeah.
For any young person out there, it's great, but just doing a social media search is not enough preparation for a trial or even a deposition. But you do, every now and then you get the social media hits of the people on vacation and parasailing.
Yeah.
At the same time, they say they can't walk. Well, I wasn't walking. I was parasailing. But, you know, you just got to do the home. You put in the legwork. And that, so often anymore, we just don't have time to do what we should be doing.
Yeah. And it's, I don't think there's any shortage of lawsuits these days, whether it be in Florida, or other states. So you're probably overwhelmed with files. And another interesting thing, which kind of, so you have a lot of files, a lot of lawsuits. And now you tell me your experience, but I've heard from many of defense counsel and firms, and I see it plastered all over LinkedIn, is everybody's looking for really good associates.
And
no one can find them. And if you find one, you better hang on for dear life, because they may pop around. What are you seeing in the industry as far as the growth of law? Because I see the files growing faster than the attorney pool growing, unfortunately.
Well, and again, we're coming out of COVID.
Yep.
You know, that screwed up everything as far as trying to develop young attorneys, because there's just no experience, there's no substitute for mentoring.
Yes.
And it doesn't, I don't know what you call it these days, but, you know, getting the associates, the young people into events, even if, my God, it's not billable.
Yeah, I know
that they get to go to depositions. They get to go in Florida. We have unsworn statements. They get to take some of these. And, you know, so many of our cases, most of our cases, are big cases.
Yes.
You know, I, you know, when I was a baby lawyer, you didn't start with medical malpractice or medical antitrust cases. You started with grocery store slip and falls.
Yes.
You know, my daughter loved the fact that I was the lawyer for Wet n Wild. That was the only thing that made me popular at the Indian Princess tribe, because I could get the whole tribe into Wet n Wild for free.
I remember, but I used to go as a kid to Wet n Wild.
Yeah. And, you know, we started with slip and falls that, you know, at Kmart or Wet n Wild or a grocery store. And you got, you know, to take the case from start to finish was your case. Mm-hmm. So you figured out what medical records were important. You figured out how to read a medical record.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not happening anymore. And that's our fault. You know, so, you know, we have to put in the time. And part of that is not requiring billable hours that are unattainable, because you're telling somebody you've got to bill time, but then you're saying, but whenever you want to, you should go be watching something that you're not billing for. And so that's on us.
Yeah, it's got to be, I think, probably got to be a cultural thing within the firm to incentivize people to do that, to get the mentorship, to get the exposure. Otherwise, you know, I don't think the attorney grows at the pace that you probably want them to. How do you deal with it with younger attorneys? And again, we've heard all the stories about these poor millennials are taking a beating, you know? Especially by us Gen X, I'm just pounding away at millennials, attorneys and non-attorneys. But the ones that I guess I sense a lack of patience and the willing to be mentored and the work ethic to, if you stick it out, it's really going to pay off. I've seen just a terrible lack of patience in this generation. How do you address that as a major partner at your firm when developing your younger talent to connect with them and keep them?
I think we have to, and you know, I'm not trying to repeat myself, but it goes back to mentorship. Mm-hmm. If all we do is give them little assignments that they don't see the start or the end, so all you're seeing is do this task and bill for it and get it back to me, then that's no, I mean, you're not building any relationship and you're not building any, you know, I don't know what word I'm looking for, but there's just not the relationship there.
Yeah. The camaraderie.
Yeah. That's a better word. Thank you. Thank God you're a wordsmith.
Yeah. that's why they hire me, man. Yeah.
Words in my life.
Yeah. I think that's an issue. And I think that, defense firms or any firm, looking at your culture and making that one of the priorities is to, yes, of course, billable hours, you absolutely have to have that. But I think this can't come 11th or 12th on your priority list. It needs to be up there and be on the same page with development of the younger attorney.
I mean, other than that, if all I am is somebody's boss, then I can't very well whine about it if a different boss offers them 10% more money.
Yeah.
If all they see is billable hours and a paycheck, and we don't have camaraderie, we don't have a relationship, it's just as much, you know, I can't be very critical. If that was my child saying, well, Dad, I don't really know my boss,
Yeah.
I've never been to his house or anything like that. So I've got a new boss who wants to pay me more. You know, how can I criticize them for going following money if that's the only thing I'm talking about with them?
Yeah, it's got to go beyond that. So let's go back to the discovery process. Do you approach a case differently depending on which plaintiff firm has filed the claim?
Somewhat, yes. And again, a lot of it, I think, goes to reputation and your experience with that firm. You know, in medical malpractice, I presume it's similar around the country. Mm-hmm. We still have a fairly small bar that does the most medical cases. And you know what you're getting. You know what, you know, if they're just a blowhard or if they just don't know what they're doing, you tend to, I have one case in particular we won't talk about, but, you know, the plaintiff lawyer just doesn't, this must be their only malpractice case because they don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And in every hearing, every proceeding, and frankly, we haven't gotten past, this will be our third motion to dismiss. you know, they just don't know what they're doing. So, yes, you know, we have some of the huge firms that, you know, advertise on, you know, we're not going to give an inch. And you have to be more aggressive with those people. You've got other very successful firms on the other side that, you know, they're going to be reasonable about things, but still successful. And, you know, you're not sweating over the little stuff, but you're still having to cooperate with them.
Now, how do you deal with the case in which it's a big popular plaintiff firm, particularly, and I know what happens here in Orlando is these South Florida guys come up here strutting, right? And they're a different breed, right? How do you deal with that type of attorney and plaintiff firm that they're not on the cooperation train? They're trying to make it. How do you do that without losing your mind, number one, but also working up the case most effectively?
Oh, and it's not just South Florida. I have to do half of a shout out for my South Florida opponents and friends. but yeah, I mean, the stereotypical out of town guy who I'm going to show you how I do it. Some of them just get horrible. There's one in particular who, you know, I mean, they're doing things like turning your witnesses into the state attorney, arguing perjury, trying to get people prosecuted for perjury.
What's this world coming to?
And, you know, it just gets to where it's, you hate to even pick up the phone with them. So, you know, and the classic is, you know, if you get to trial or when you finally get to trial, you know, as you're introducing yourself, you know, I'm Chuck Ingram of Estes Ingram Foles and Gibbs here in Orlando. And, you know, do any of you know Mr. Jones from Miami?
Yeah.
but, you know, even the big firms, when you talk to lawyers, there's good and bad in that.
Yeah.
It just so happened my wife was on a Vore Dire panel a month or two ago, and I knew very well the attorneys on both sides. And, you know, she was chatting with other potential jurors, and just as many people are turned off by the big firm, big attitude lawyers as are impressed by it.
It cuts, you know, both ways.
And she, you know, this was a particularly large firm here in Central Florida talking about how how many of you know us? How many of you love my family? You know, for all the good we do. And it just got a little thick. But, you know, I'm not saying my wife's objective, but, you know, she's a much more objective than I am.
Yeah. Now, different problem, but kind of similarly, this does happen, not all the time. I think it's probably pretty rare. But in the defense world, you have competitors and you have other law, other defense firms, and they may be representing co-defendants in your case where there could be some potential crossfire. How do you approach a case when there's multiple defendants and multiple defense attorneys involved? And ideally, I think you'd want some sort of joint defense philosophy, but that's not always the case, is it?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
You do want it, but it doesn't always happen.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's unavoidable. That's changing with time. I think, you know, civility in general is changing with time, and maybe that's not the right title. But there's a lot of what's in it for me. And if I throw somebody else under the bus, it somehow makes my client look better, where I think generally that brings us all down.
Yeah.
You know, I'm working with one group as a co-defendant, and they're very formal on a co-defense agreement. Now, it doesn't mean we have to all agree on everything, mm-hmm. but it's all confidential. It's all, you know, it's all written out. And there's nothing wrong with that formality or that level of formality. I guess, you know, once if you've been burned once, you want to be very formal with it. But, you know, it used to be, you know, we just all, you know, your word was your was good enough.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of it's unavoidable. You know, I have a lot of cases where the doctors don't agree on what happened.
Yeah.
I have cases where the nurses don't agree with the doctors on what happened. And our general thought process is, you know, it doesn't help us to abuse someone else. But in this day with, you know, in Florida anyway, the comparative fault and Fabre, where you can place other, you know, even non-parties on the verdict form, it's pretty rare still where a co-defendant is actively going after someone else, even after a settlement. But it's not unusual to, you know, even after a settlement, to use the plaintiff's expert to, you know, put something on your former co-defendant. But I don't know of anything specific you can do to stop it. And, you know, there are friends of mine who are notorious for that. You know, what's Sam going to do today? You know, we trust, you know, I'm not going to trust him until this deposition ends. You know, most of the time as a co-defendant, you'll get a heads up. Hey, don't go here. But there are others who, you know, go out of their way even at the end of a deposition. Well, you didn't bring this up, but how about this? And I don't know, other than just knowing people and working with people, which isn't what it used to be.
Yeah, the world has changed, huh?
True. I guess that's, you know, for the better. You know, we're all, you know, can't we just all get along?
Yeah. So I heard this recently on a plaintiff attorney podcast, and I want to run it by you. And this attorney, a plaintiff attorney, was saying, listen, in many industries, including MedMal, the reason for some of these crazy catastrophic verdicts you see on the news, one of the main reasons for that is that defendants and defense attorneys are too proud, have too much pride to admit liability on cases in which they really should And that's how they're getting hammered by juries. True or false?
At least partially true.
Because you're fighting a battle that, like, you're going to die on a hill where you kind of know, but you don't. Yeah, admitting liability, I think, is very emotional and tough across the board. But there are some cases in all industries where it's the number one right thing to do. Right. And this attorney said, he goes, they won't do it for a number of reasons. Number one, you look like a coward, right? The defense attorney's like, I ain't settling shit, right? I mean, you look like a coward. And then the hospital's like, well, I don't want to turn into an ATM machine. We can't admit liability because then it's going to go off the rails. And there's a lot of barriers to doing that. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
Well, there are certainly barriers. And, you know, the biggest in my industry is consent insurance policies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is very difficult to get a physician who has a consent policy to, you know, often to agree to settle, much less to admit liability.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you know, in Florida, we have a pre-suit system that allows for arbitration of damages with an admission of responsibility. And I'm seeing that happen more often in the last 3 years than I've seen in the last 30 years. So I think that's changing. But, you know, the fact of, you know, if you're going to admit liability, the flip side of that becomes true. Well, we have to have some defense to this nuclear, you know, okay, now we're going to get a $40 million life care plan. Although the flip side of that is you were going to get the $40 million life care plan anyway.
Yeah.
So maybe if we can build some credibility on the front side, they'll give us some credibility on the backside.
Yeah.
But I think it's definitely, there is truth to it, that a lot of it's attitude and just somewhat ego, but more driven by the realities of insurance policies.
Sure. Now, you and I have done plenty between training witnesses for deposition and trial and jury research. You and I have done so much of that. Could you speak to the impact of doing whether it be a mock trial or a focus group, to listen to real people from your venue, listen to them talk about your case versus you in the conference room with your partners and associates, because you guys see the world differently. The value to that, to listening to just regular everyday people usually tearing you a new one, right, during the focus group or a deliberation, the type of perspective that gives you versus the internal perspective.
Well, as you are aware, because you've helped me with my program, with the Florida Bar, I'm involved with their advanced trial advocacy program at the University of Florida every May. And I've been with the program for 20 some years. And that's one of our, what I think really becomes a value to litigators, young and old, is we have a voir dire presentation, similar to what you guys do behind the scenes.
Yep.
And they get an opening statement, they see evidence and closing arguments, and then we split them up and record them. And that's been my job for 10 or 15 years, is editing down the deliberations and seeing what real people, how they react to people, is amazing. You know, who would have thought that? Or, you know, who heard that? And, you know, where did they come from on this?
Yeah.
And I guess it's more in your world and trying to figure it out in mine, is the same, you know, the two separate juries come to a totally different outcome.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you explain that, except as you've been trying to teach me, you know, you're looking for patterns. You're looking for what works, what stands out, what doesn't. And the issues we think are important sometimes the jury doesn't care.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our newest problem at the Florida Bar Program is a SUV hitting a bicyclist, killing him in a crosswalk. And for now 2 years in a row, because one of the issues is, was he speeding? And 2 years in a row now, jurors have picked up on, well, wait a minute, there's still stuff on the front seat next to him. And if there's stuff on the front seat next to him in these pictures, he couldn't have slammed on the brakes because all that stuff would have gone to the floor. And it's really? Like,
who's going to pick up on that?
You know, no lawyer has yet picked up on it. And now 2 years in a row, juries have picked up on it. It's just little issues that, you know, in every one of our cases, you know, you don't want to talk about them because often they're ongoing cases, but spotting the issues, you know, does the jury think this is important? And I'm interested in doing one of your new programs where you do two separate
change it up.
Focus groups and see what changes and what makes a difference and what doesn't.
Yeah.
It's not cheap, but I think it's worthwhile.
Yeah. Cause knowledge is power, right? Knowledge is power. And I told you this on the phone while I was at the gym and you were yelling at me over my earbuds, is I said, my number one goal for the research project is learning how to lose this case. There's many ways to win. We'll figure that out. I want to know how to lose this case, which is, I think, the number one goal when you're doing stuff like that. Because there's several different ways to win, and you want to learn how to win, but you really want to learn how to lose. And so if you do have something that's not working out for you, or one of your expert opinions is not landing, you have the time and the knowledge now to do something about it, which goes into my next question, which is another true or false that I've heard a lot of. Med-mal defense attorneys overvalue and over rely on expert witnesses as opposed to their fact witnesses.
Probably true. You know, you have to have experts, you have to have a good expert, but so often the experts cancel each other out and, you know, talk over the jury who've already made up their mind, you know, from how your doctor did, how the plaintiff did. I mean, the plaintiff's always going to have sympathy on their side.
Sure.
I mean, dealing with bad outcomes, that's 100% of what we do.
Yeah.
Nobody goes to a lawyer if it's a good outcome.
Yeah. And this is a very important follow-up question because this is debatable. What is your opinion? We actually did a full podcast on this topic. It was so hot, but I want your opinion. When hiring an expert, there's a couple different ways to look at this. You get the Harvard or University of Chicago, UCLA, Cedar Sinai. You go for somebody out of town, nationally, just the most qualified person, out of town expert. They're a clinical professor at Harvard, whatever. And you bring that into Orlando versus you get the very best local person at the local hospital. And that's your way. Where do you side on that one? Because I think this is a fascinating question.
I tend to think local is better. But I do think it kind of depends on what you're opposing.
Yeah.
If the plaintiff's expert is, you know, the head of the department at Harvard and has written 20 papers on this, and the local people, particularly, you know, in a, you know, the more suburban locations, you know, I like real world experts and be able to say, you know, well, how many states did you have to fly over to get here? Or nowadays, you know, well, okay, doctor, did I understand you're in Boston today on your video screen? You know, Have you ever been to Sebring?
I think that's really important. And then secondly, with your choice of experts, what are your, I mean, I've heard a lot of defense attorneys say, I want an expert that's testified on both sides, right? Is that something important to you as far as balance? Like, you don't just want someone that does defense work, right? You want, I would assume you want someone that's done, it doesn't have to be 50-50, but maybe 60-40 in one direction.
In a perfect world, yes.
Yeah.
You know, because you want somebody with good objectivity who's on your side. You know, that's not always possible. You know, that, you know, it's getting harder and harder. Experts like making the money, but it's getting harder and harder to get people who want to get involved as an expert, particularly the, you know, the university types. It's time consuming.
Yeah.
And particularly, you know, I've literally had experts who won't come to trial. And, you know, if you don't find that out up front, that gets very expensive.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, last question. And then we're going to wrap this up. I think this has been fantastic. When you have a case that comes in, and again, I think there's a range of kind of, okay, this case is okay. Okay, well, this is a tough case versus, oh boy, this one's rough. I know in my experience in MedMal, I think that the birth injury cases are way up there, are way, 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 way up there. Are highly sympathetic. And sometimes you have a child that dies during, childbirth or shortly thereafter, or they survive and now they're, you know, they have catastrophic, you know, cognitive and physical, problems. I'm not really sure it gets more sympathetic, than that. When one of those, comes in, I think, obviously, you're handling the case very seriously, right? Because of the level of sympathy and the potential exposure. How do you, and you and I have been down this road, I want you to describe it though. How do you deal with your witnesses, particularly the nurses in these cases, where they come into your office for that first meeting and they're distraught, right, Chuck? I mean, these nurses are destroyed of what happened in a birth injury and they're just, they're really hard to deal with emotionally. How do you approach that? Because I see those as being really tough cases for nurses in particular.
I think you're right. They are, we have a related problem in birth injury cases. In many times, mom says, I'll never forget what happened.
Yeah.
Whereas the nurses are saying, I don't remember what happened in that birth, that delivery 4 years ago and 600 patients ago.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm not going to be sexist, but I think as a profession, physicians are better able to handle that kind of stress because the nurses are a more caring profession and they're hands-on. They're the ones who deal with these patients all day long, all shift long, and see their real problems. So, you know, I don't think there's any substitute for a lot of preparation. And we're not talking, I can remember when you met with somebody an hour before their deposition and that was it. But now, I mean, it's weeks in advance of the deposition. Let's start getting ready, you know, not coaching you on what to say, but coaching you on, or training, if that's the better word, on how to react.
Yeah.
You know, don't think of lawyers as humans because then you give them humanoid qualities. you know, just think of them as lizards. So that, me too, you know, so you don't react to lizards like you do to humans. So any event, any emotional witness is going to take more work to bring them around to, I'm not here to tell you what to say. I'm just here to try to get you to not react
to
what they say.
Yeah. A lot of these providers take this stuff personally.
Yes.
And there's a lot of grief. Sometimes there's a lot of guilt. Sometimes there's anger, but a lot of time it's more the sadness, the overwhelming guilt. And then I see they want to blame themselves. They actually start second guessing their care. And I must have done something wrong because I was the nurse. And there's a lot of head work, right? Psychology and emotional stuff going on in those early meetings. And I think you would agree with me that has to be on one of the top on your priority list to address that and not wait.
Right. I mean, most of my work is hospital work.
Yeah.
So, you know, and now, you know, there are many more physicians employed by hospitals, but, you know, the nurse is an interesting witness as a stereotypical.
Yeah.
Again, they're there all day and it's personal to them. They wouldn't be in this profession if they weren't empathetic, caring people.
Yeah.
And there's going to be sympathy in every one of our cases because if there wasn't an injury, there wouldn't be a lawsuit.
Absolutely. Okay, let's wrap up. Final issue, but I had to save this for last. We are both ACC guys. You're a Florida State guy. I'm a Tar Heel. Fill in the blank, Mr. Ingram. Florida State will belong in X conference 2 years from now. Where are they going to end up landing?
It's looking like the Big Ten.
You know, that trip to East Lansing in the, you know, in November is not going to be fun. You are aware of that, right?
Well, yeah, I've been to East Lansing. I had an expert there. But I've been to Iowa. As you know, I scout for certain bowl games.
Yes.
But the fact is, I don't think the SEC wants to share with Florida State. They already have a presence in the state. And it's all
you won't even say their name? You won't even say their name?
I've heard of them.
Yeah.
I like a lot of the facilities in Gainesville. but they already have a presence, and everything is coming down to ESPN money.
It's all about the money.
And, you know, if you want to sell in Florida, you know, let's sell bowl games or Big Ten games.
Wow. Very interesting.
Although that'll cause problems in my household.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure.
My wife's Ohio State.
Oh, well, there you go. That would be very interesting. But I tell you what, seeing Florida State play in the horseshoe would be phenomenal.
Yeah.
I think that'd be great. And you know, the Ohio State guys cannot come to Florida and they'll like be dehydrated and out of it by halftime. They can't handle this weather.
They won't come till November.
Yeah, guys, if they're smart. Well, Chuck, thanks so much for being on the show. I think this was a fantastic conversation, which will be added to our MedMal series to our audience members. Thank you so much for participating in this edition of the Litigation Psychology Podcast. We will see you next time.